Welcome to the Royal Academy of Arts podcast. I'm Lawrence Pollard. At the RA this summer, you'll find dinosaurs browsing by the shores of Piccadilly and the modern world emerging on the coast of Normandy, as described in the paintings of Monet, Manet and Boudin. In a little while, we'll be standing under tons of steel in the courtyard of the RA, but first, a taster of the show that's in the Sackler Gallery for the whole of the summer, the often surprising Impressionists by the Sea. If that sound conjures up the seaside world of distant horizons and wide beaches, then you're probably dreaming of getting away from it all. But in the later 19th century, the seaside holiday as we know it, and still enjoy it, was quite the new thing. The Normandy coast of northern France, around the towns of Trouville and Deauville near Le Havre, was the scene for a new social phenomenon.
The guests at Trouville are that floating, parasitic mass of people who come in the summer in search of health or pleasure. Nothing is more colourful than this elegant crowd, whether healthy or sick. The pretensions of class disappear in face of the splendour and grandeur of the ocean.
The Impressionists saw themselves as painters of modern life. So, naturally, as well as focusing on the pleasures of the city, they were drawn to these new adventures out on the Normandy coast. And that's why this show has been put on. One of the chief curators is Professor John House of London's Courtauld Institute.
The exhibition's trying to look again, of course, at the Impressionists' work, and this is something, there have been a lot of Impressionist exhibitions, but the purpose of this one is to try and set a rather wider context, because we include a whole range of paintings, not by the Impressionists themselves, but pictures that were exhibited at the big Parisian exhibitions at the same time, representing the seacoast, and also a whole range of work by their predecessors who were working on the Normandy coast. Already by the time the Impressionists first went to Normandy, there was quite a long tradition of painting the Normandy coast and exploring that very distinctive light, silvery, pearly blue light. And that, with the figures set against that light, gives it a very, very distinctive quality. Later on, the Impressionists go to the south of France and indeed develop a completely different sort of colour, a much, much richer, more intense, vibrant colour, as against this rather more pearly, light-toned colour that they develop on the north coast. And also, we're looking at it, particularly in the catalogue, in relation to the development of the seaside resort, this fast change that went along the seacoast during the period under discussion from 1850 to around 1890.
Great names involved, of course, Manet, Monet and Boudin. Should we think of them as going on a working holiday, or do they single out this landscape and this seascape as something that they wanted to go and explore? How did they do their painting?
I think one sees it as a place of work. Straightforwardly, Monet goes to a place for sometimes several weeks, very often several months, and he explores the place, he explores possible sites to represent, he does an awful lot of walking, and then he settles on various spots, and each day is a working day. Of course, it depended on the weather, whether he could work out of doors, and on the weather being the sort of weather he wanted for a particular subject. But essentially, this is a work site.
One of the things that made their art distinctive was that they painted en plein air, in the open air. That's what we should think of them painting by the seaside as well. Is it perched on a beach or on a rock or on a cliff?
Well, one wonderful bit of evidence of a thing being painted out of doors is indeed finding sand stuck in the paint surface. And this is something that's been found in a number of the smaller, more informal pictures. And also there were moments when the paint literally adhered to the painters in a rather more dramatic way, as the famous story when Monet was working down on a seacoast and misread the tide tables and thought the tide was going out when in fact it was coming in and got hit by a very large wave. And went back completely covered in paint and totally soaking because his canvas had been thrown in his face so that his painting ended up all down his shirt front.
And how would you place the seaside paintings along this stretch of the coast in the bigger story of Impressionism? Is it something that they did after they'd explored the city, before they went to the south of France? I mean, is it a discrete moment or is it something that they do all the time throughout their careers?
Particularly for Monet, the sea was an absolutely central theme. He was in fact brought up on the seaside on the Normandy coast. He went there at the age of four with his family to Le Havre, and he keeps on going back. There are periods when he stops for 10 years or so in the later 1870s, but then he goes back again. And even after he was quite unable to paint out of doors, right at the end of his life when he was aged around 80, we know that he went down to the seacoast to watch a jolly good storm, just to get blasted by the waves of the channel.
And what do you think particularly stands out when you look at these?
There's just one bit of one painting that I found completely extraordinary, and this is the profile head of by Manet, of Manet's wife, seated on the beach at Berck in 1873. She's wearing a hat with a veil down across her face and down across the top of her back, and you can see her profile through this veil, treated in the most delicate way, with little tiny flecks of paint indicating the profile of her nose and also, indeed, even her eyelashes.
Well, it looks like an eyelash there. Which
absolutely,
is charming.
But it's done with such informality and freedom that it looks as if it's done all at once. But again, it's the result of astonishing care and an amazing sort of finesse and virtuosity of observation and, of course, of handling of paint. If there was one small part of a painting, I would take Manet's wife's profile.
Looking at the paintings, you can see the obvious appeal of the play of light and the breezy views on the Normandy coast, and also the very strong geometry of the sea's flat horizon. But what about the social story that's being told? Who are these holidaymakers all dressed up to sit on the sand? Where are the fishermen and their families? What the exhibition shows is how earlier artists began with a fascination for the lives of the locals, then attention turned to the holiday-making new arrivals, and then again the Impressionists would often just empty the landscape of all but sea and sky. Dr. David Hopkin of Hertford College, Oxford, knows all about the social changes which are going on in the background of these paintings as Parisian life and artists came up against the older lifestyle of the fishermen that they found.
The initial interest in the coast from artists, the people going there in the 1830s, 1840s, they were interested in the actual fishermen, and you can see that in their paintings, that they have these kind of anthropological interest in the exoticism of the fisherfolk, their way of life, their dress and things like that. And they loom much larger in their actual finished paintings. But when the Impressionists arrive, in a sense they're catching a moment where those people are almost being excluded from the beach, less visible on the beach, that other people are taking their place, the promenaders, the holiday makers. The interest of the Impressionists is more towards the play of wind and rain and sun and sea and all those kind of things, and less looking at the actual fisherfolk themselves.
Professor John House again.
The seacoast was changing very rapidly in the second half of the 19th century with the emergence of holiday resorts. And clearly the seacoast represented something for the Impressionists that was a new sort of modern subject matter. They were fascinated by the modernity of the city, and on the seacoast, when they first go there, they are, again, fascinated by that aspect of it, the new resorts and the people who went there on vacation.
It is the meeting place of the sick who are perfectly healthy. It is Paris transported for 2 or 3 months to the seacoast, with its qualities, absurdities and its vices. It is sad to say that most of the women go there only to parade a senseless luxury.
In the 19th century, particularly by the 1860s, people described the beaches of resorts like Trouville as being the summer boulevard of Paris. It was the people who strutted up and down wearing their fashionable gear in Paris through most of the year who would end up wearing the summer version of the same gear strutting around on the beach at Trouville in July and August.
They come possessed. They bring their burden of extravagance with them. They take it down to the beach. They plunge into the water with it and come up burdened as before. Dress is the one thing needful at Trouville, in the water or on the sands.
Certainly the smarter, richer people would be just as formal on the beach as they were in Paris, and there are accounts in the books and the guidebooks about how you had to take 5 different changes of costume every day to accommodate with the walk just after breakfast, and then you change for lunch, and then you change for your afternoon walk, and of course you change for your pre-dinner drinks, and again for dinner. So that sort of person would be changing their clothes all the time. But of course there would have been a much, much larger layer of society who were also holidaymakers, who probably had just 1 or 2 dresses per day.
And although you might not think you can see any fishermen in these pictures, in fact they are there. They're just doing their new jobs, as Dr. David Hopkin explains.
Fishermen lead extremely hard lives, and the new opportunities in the service industries which the tourists bring with them are actually quite attractive. And so having been fishermen, they now become swimming instructors, they become guides to the local area and things like that. So they're making money out of the tourists, and easier money than the money which they used to make out of fishing, which is a highly dangerous business and not necessarily one which they would eagerly perform.
The paintings give a fantastic impression of Trouville, the town, What's it like now? It kind of makes me want to go and see how close it still is to these wonderful, huge skies, big beaches, beautiful architecture. What's Trouville like now?
Well, all the skies and the beaches are still there, of course, and at low tide, the beach at Trouville is absolutely enormous. The sea almost disappears, and a lot of the architecture that you see in the pictures is still there now. The Hotel des Roches Noires that there's a Monet picture of in the exhibition, that is now actually a block of luxury apartments, but the building is still there, a building erected in the 1860s. And a lot of the architecture is very much of this type, although bits of it have been rebuilt later in the 19th century. But in a sense, when the Vogue went to the south of France, it meant that these northern French places kind of slowed down, so they weren't so elaborately redeveloped. And so a lot of the 19th century architecture is virtually intact.
Impressionists by the Sea can be enjoyed until the 30th of September. You can book tickets in advance online at www.royalacademy.org.uk. What you're hearing now isn't, I'm afraid, the surf at Trouville, but rather it's the fountains in the lovely courtyard here at the Royal Academy. This used to be a car park, but it's more like a sculpture park now. There are fountains, benches, you can grab a coffee and admire three dinosaurs. Three huge steel dinosaurs. You can probably hear the echo in the background as I stand here in the belly of one of them. They are the work of Jake and Dinos Chapman, the celebrated and controversial Brit artists. The dinosaurs look like, well, they look like they'd be made out of rips and strips of paper, rather like a child might build them up. But actually, it's tough, rusting steel. This is the latest commission for the courtyard by the Academy's sculpture curator, Edith Devaney, who's here underneath the beasts with me. Edith, we're halfway here between the road, Piccadilly, over there, and the galleries over there. Why put public sculpture here?
Well, Burlington House, where we're standing now in the courtyard, is actually quite an imposing space. And I think a lot of people passing on Piccadilly think it might be a corporate building, it might be offices or something like that. But we think that the most effective tool that we have is using the courtyard to show public sculpture, because it really does map out what we do. We're here to show art, and here it is.
I should also say that whatever the collective now, it's probably a herd of dinosaurs or a flock of dinosaurs. It's a very friendly flock, and you see people smile as they come in. Now, it's a friendly and a nice sculpture from the Chapman brothers, who are often called the Brothers Grimm. They're not always the most, let's say, the softest of artists. Were you sure that you were going to get something this involving and inviting from them?
We were pretty sure, actually. They'd worked in little models of dinosaurs. That's something they'd been doing for quite a long time, and they'd churn them at the Tate. And we knew that they wanted to make very big, life-size versions of these pieces. What I love about them is, yes, they're exactly as you described them. They've got a childlike charm to them. They're very friendly. The material, again, is very interesting, because they're kind of friendly creatures made in a very harsh material. It's a Corten steel, so it rusts naturally, and it's looking kind of very orangey, rusty coloured now, which is quite hard. It's quite a brutal material. And Jake and Dinos had actually said that they were echoing Richard Serra's work, and they wanted these to look as if they were the work of Richard Serra's delinquent sons. And I think they've pretty much achieved that.
You can probably hear someone behind us tapping them and giving them a little bit of a drum to hear the echo. Now, the commission that was here before were these two very mysterious towers by the German artist Anselm Kiefer that looked like they were on the verge of falling down. Now, they were a very different sort of experience to this. They were an intriguing, slightly alarming, slightly is-it-safe-to-walk-near-it kind of experience. What are the sort of reactions that you want from people? Because here, they make you laugh, these dinosaurs. They make you smile. They make you tap them like that.
I think we're aiming to challenge people's perceptions about public sculpture, that it can be all things. You know, as you say, these are very friendly. They're very funny. They're great. The towers were more difficult. People either loved them or hated them. There was something very poetic about them. I think everyone went away with this feeling they'd seen something quite special.
Now, one complaint that's often made about public art is that it's an add-on or a tack-on, and you see people sitting on it and picnicking it and using it as a bench rather than admiring it. Do you have a perfect idea for how you'd like people to use these? Do you want them to walk through them? Can they sit on them and picnic under them? What's the use for a public sculpture that you think is appropriate?
I mean, I hate the word interact, but I think it is wonderful if people are able to go close to them, to be able to touch them. I think also, when we have a changing sculpture program like we do here, people do notice it. When you have a piece of permanent public sculpture, it becomes very much part of the furniture, and people just treat it like a bench or a tree that they sit under, and they stop looking at it. I think it's very important to have this continually changing programme, and people never know quite what to expect when they come in.
The dinosaurs will be enticing you off Piccadilly to enjoy a cup of coffee under the courtyard awnings throughout the summer. You can also explore the free exhibitions in the fine rooms, or you can just enjoy the Friday night jazz sessions in the restaurant lobby. All details, of course, can be found on the website www.royalacademy.org.uk. Thanks for listening.